Chapter 27. Blessed Leon the Water was reflected in its minute fibers with a fidelity unsurpassed by the most exquisitely polished mirror. A small island, fairly laughing with flowers in full bloom, and affording little more space than just enough for a picturesque little building, seemingly a fowl house, arose from the lake not far from its northern shore, to which it was connected by means of an inconceivably light-looking, and yet very primitive bridge. It was formed of a single, broad and thick plank of the tulip wood. This was 40 feet long, and spanned the interval between shore and shore with a slight, but very perceptible arch, preventing all oscillation. From the southern extreme of the lake, issued a continuation of the rivulet, which, after meandering for, perhaps, 30 yards, finally passed through the depression already described, in the middle of the southern declivity, and tumbling down a sheer precipice of 100 feet, made its devious and unnoticed way to the Hudson. The lake was deep at some points 30 feet, but the rivulet seldom exceeded 3, while its greatest width was about 8. Its bottom and banks were as those of the pond, if a defect could have been attributed. In point of picturesqueness, it was that of excessive neatness. The expanse of the green turf was relieved, here and there, by an occasional showy shrub, such as the hydrangea, or the common snowball, or the aromatic syringa, or, more frequently, by a clump of geraniums blossoming gorgeously in great varieties. These latter grew in pots which were carefully buried in the soil, so as to give the plants the appearance of being indigenous. Besides all this, the lawn's velvet was exquisitely spotted with sheep, a considerable flock, of which roamed about the vale, in company with 3 tame deer, and a vast number of brilliantly plumed ducks. A very large mastiff seemed to be in vigilant attendance upon these animals, each and all. Along the eastern and western cliffs where, toward the upper portion of the amphitheater, the boundaries were more or less precipitous, grew ivy in great profusion, so that only here and there could even a glimpse of the naked rock be obtained. The northern precipice, in like manner, was almost entirely clothed by grapevines of rare luxuriance, some springing from the soil at the base of the cliff, and others from ledges on its face. The slight elevation which formed the lower boundary of this little domain was crowned by a neat stone wall, of sufficient height to prevent the escape of the deer. Nothing of the fence kind was observable elsewhere, for nowhere else was an artificial enclosure needed. Any stray sheep, for example, which should attempt to make its way out of the vale by means of the ravine, would find its progress arrested, after a few yards advance, by the precipitous ledge of rock over which tumbled the cascade that had arrested my attention as I first drew near the domain. In short, the only ingress or egress was through a gate occupying a rocky pass in the road, a few paces below the point at which I stopped to reconnoiter the scene. I have described the brook as meandering very irregularly through the whole of its course. Its 2 general directions, as I have said, were first from west to east, and then from north to south. At the turn, the stream, sweeping backward, made an almost circular loop, so as to form a peninsula which was very nearly an island, and which included about the 1/16 of an acre. On this peninsula, stood a dwelling house, and when I say that this house, like the infernal terrace seen by Vathek, edit Dune architecture in Connu Dan's Les Annales de la Terre, I mean, merely, that its stout ensemble struck me with the keenest sense of combined novelty and propriety in the word, of poetry, for, than in the words just employed, I could scarcely give, of poetry in the abstract, a more rigorous definition, and I do not mean that merely outree was perceptible in any respect. In fact, nothing could well be more simple, more utterly unpretending than this cottage. Its marvelous effect lay altogether in its artistic arrangement as a picture. I could have fancied, while I looked at it, that some eminent landscape painter had built it with his brush. The point of view from which I first saw the valley was not altogether, although it was nearly, the best point from which to survey the house. I will therefore describe it as I afterwards saw it from a position on the stone wall at the southern extreme of the amphitheater. The main building was about 24 feet long and 16 broad, certainly not more. Its total height, from the ground to the apex of the roof, could not have exceeded 18 feet. To the west end of this structure was attached one about a third smaller in all its proportions. The line of its front standing back about 2 yards from that of the larger house, and the line of its roof, of course, being considerably depressed below that of the roof adjoining. At right angles to these buildings, and from the rear of the main one not exactly in the middle, extended a third compartment, very small being, in general, one-third less than the western wing. The roofs of the two larger were very steep, sweeping down from the ridge beam with a long concave curve, and extending at least 4 feet beyond the walls in front, so as to form the roofs of two piazzas. These latter roofs, of course, needed no support, but as they had the air of needing it, slight and perfectly plain pillars were inserted at the corners alone. The roof of the northern wing was merely an extension of a portion of the main roof. Between the chief building and western wing arose a very tall and rather slender square chimney of hard Dutch bricks, alternately black and red. A slight cornice of projecting bricks at the top. Over the gables the roofs also projected very much. In the main building about 4 feet to the east and 2 to the west, the principal door was not exactly in the main division, being a little to the east, while the two windows were to the west. These latter did not extend to the floor, but were much longer and narrower than usual. They had single shutters like doors. The panes were of lozenge form, but quite large. The door itself had its upper half of glass, also in lozenge panes. A movable shutter secured it at night. The door to the west wing was in its gable, and quite simple. A single window looked out to the south. There was no external door to the north wing, and it also had only one window to the east. The blank wall of the eastern gable was relieved by stairs with a balustrade running diagonally across it, the ascent being from the south. Under cover of the widely projecting eave, these steps gave access to a door leading to the garret, or rather loft, for it was lighted only by a single window to the north, and seemed to have been intended as a storeroom. The piazzas of the main building and western wing had no floors, as is usual, but at the doors, and at each window, large, flat irregular slabs of granite lay embedded in the delicious turf, affording comfortable footing in all weather. Excellent paths of the same material, not nicely adapted, but with the velvety sod filling frequent intervals between the stones, led hither and thither from the house, to a crystal spring about 5 paces off, to the road, or to one or two outhouses that lay to the north, beyond the brook, and were thoroughly concealed by a few locusts and catalpas. Not more than 6 steps from the main door of the cottage stood the dead trunk of a fantastic pear tree, so clothed from head to foot in the gorgeous bignonia blossoms that one required no little scrutiny to determine what manner of sweet thing it could be. From various arms of this tree hung cages of different kinds. In one, a large wicker cylinder with a ring atop, reveled a mockingbird. In another, an oriole. In a third, the impudent bobolink, while 3 or 4 more delicate prisons were loudly vocal with canaries. The pillars of the piazza were enwreathed in jasmine and sweet honeysuckle, while from the angle formed by the main structure and its west wing, in front, sprang a grapevine of unexampled luxuriance. Scorning all restraint, it had clambered first to the lower roof, then to the higher, and along the ridge of this ladder it continued to writhe on, throwing out tendrils to the right and left, until at length it fairly attained the east gable, and fell trailing over the stairs. The whole house, with its wings, was constructed of the old-fashioned Dutch shingles, broad, and with unrounded corners. It is a peculiarity of this material to give houses built of it the appearance of being wider at bottom than at top, after the manner of Egyptian architecture. And in the present instance, this exceedingly picturesque effect was aided by numerous pots of gorgeous flowers that almost encompassed the base of the buildings. The shingles were painted a dull gray, and the happiness with which this neutral tint melted into the vivid green of the tulip tree leaves that partially overshadowed the cottage can readily be conceived by an artist. From the position near the stone wall, as described, the buildings were seen at great advantage, for the southeastern angle was thrown forward, so that the eye took in at once the whole of the two fronts, with the picturesque eastern gable, and at the same time obtained just a sufficient glimpse of the northern wing, with parts of a pretty roof to the spring house, and nearly half of a light bridge that spanned the brook in the near vicinity of the main buildings. I did not remain very long on the brow of the hill, although long enough to make a thorough survey of the scene at my feet. It was clear that I had wandered from the road to the village, and I had thus good traveler's excuse to open the gate before me, and inquire my way, at all events. So, without more ado, I proceeded. The road, after passing the gate, seemed to lie upon a natural ledge, sloping gradually down along the face of the northeastern cliffs. It led me on to the foot of the northern precipice, and thence over the bridge, round by the eastern gable to the front door. In this progress, I took notice that no sight of the outhouses could be obtained. As I turned the corner of the gable, the mastiff bounded towards me in stern silence, but with the eye and the whole air of a tiger. I held him out my hand, however, in token of amity, and I never yet knew the dog who was proof against such an appeal to his courtesy. He not only shut his mouth, and wagged his tail, but absolutely offered me his paw, afterward extending his civilities to Ponto. As no bell was discernible, I rapped with my stick against the door, which stood half open. Instantly a figure advanced to the threshold, that of a young woman about 28 years of age, slender, or rather slight, and somewhat above the medium height. As she approached, with a certain modest decision of step altogether indescribable, I said to myself, "Surely here I have found the perfection of natural, in contradistinction from artificial grace." The second impression which she made on me, but by far the more vivid of the two, was that of enthusiasm. So intense an expression of romance, perhaps I should call it, or of unworldliness, as that which gleamed from her deep-set eyes, had never so sunk into my heart of hearts before. I know not how it is, but this peculiar expression of the eye, wreathing itself occasionally into the lips, is the most powerful, if not absolutely the sole spell, which rivets my interest in woman. Our romance, provided my readers fully comprehended what I would here imply by the word omens and omenliness, seemed to me convertible terms. And, after all, what man truly loves in woman is simply her womanhood. "The eyes of Annie," I heard someone from the interior call her, "my darling," were perpetual gray, her hair a light chestnut. This is all I had time to observe of her. At her most courteous of invitations, I entered, passing first into a tolerably wide vestibule. Having come mainly to observe, I took notice that to my right as I stepped in was a window, such as those in front of the house. To the left, a door leading into the principal room, while, opposite me, an open door enabled me to see a small apartment, just the size of the vestibule, arranged as a study, and having a large bow window looking out to the north. Passing into the parlor, I found myself with Mr. Lander, for this, I afterwards found, was his name. He was civil, even cordial in his manner, but just then, I was more intent on observing the arrangements of the dwelling which had so much interested me, than the personal appearance of the tenant. The north wing, I now saw, was a bedchamber, its door opened into the parlor. West of this door, was a single window, looking toward the brook. At the west end of the parlor, were a fireplace, and a door leading into the west wing, probably a kitchen. Nothing could be more rigorously simple than the furniture of the parlor. On the floor was an ingrain carpet, of excellent texture, a white ground, spotted with small circular green figures. At the windows were curtains of snowy white jacquinet muslin. They were tolerably full, and hung decisively, perhaps rather formally, in sharp, parallel plates to the floor, just to the floor. The walls were prepared with a French paper of great delicacy, a silver ground, with a faint green cord running zigzag throughout. Its expanse was relieved merely by three of Julian's exquisite lithographs, a choice crayons, fastened to the wall without frames. One of these drawings was a scene of Oriental luxury, or rather voluptuousness. Another was a carnival piece, spirited beyond compare. The third was a Greek female head, a face so divinely beautiful, and yet of an expression so provokingly indeterminate, never before arrested my attention. The more substantial furniture consisted of a round table, a few chairs, including a large rocking chair, and a sofa, or rather settee. Its material was plain maple painted a creamy white, slightly interstripped with green, the seat of cane. The chairs and table were o match, but the forms of all had evidently been designed by the same brain which planned, he grounds. It is impossible to conceive anything more graceful. On the table were a few books, a large, square, crystal bottle of some novel perfume, a plain ground glass astral, not solar, lamp with an Italian shade, and a large vase of resplendently blooming flowers. Flowers, indeed, of gorgeous colors and delicate odor formed the sole mere decoration of the apartment. The fireplace was nearly filled with a vase of brilliant geranium. On a triangular shelf in each angle of the room stood also a similar vase, varied only as to its lovely contents. One or two smaller bouquets adorned the mantel, and late violets clustered about the open windows. It is not the purpose of this work to do more than give in detail a picture of Mr. Lander's residence as I found it. How he made it what it was, and why with some particulars of Mr. Lander himself may possibly form the subject of another article. William Wilson, what say of it? What say of conscience grim, that specter in my path? Chamberlain's Farinita. Let me call myself, for the present, William Wilson. The fair page now lying before me need not be sullied with my real appellation. This has been already too much an object for the scorn, for the horror, for the detestation of my race. To the uttermost regions of the globe, have not the indignant winds bruited its unparalleled infamy? Oh, outcast of all outcasts most abandoned! To the earth art thou not forever dead? To its honors, to its flowers, to its golden aspirations? And a cloud, dense, dismal, and limitless, does it not hang eternally between thy hopes and heaven? I would not, if I could, here today, embody a record of my later years of unspeakable misery and unpardonable crime. This epoch these later years took unto themselves a sudden elevation in turpitude, whose origin alone it is my present purpose to assign. Men usually grow base by degrees. From me, in an instant, all virtue dropped bodily as a mantle. From comparatively trivial wickedness I passed, with the stride of a giant, into more than the enormities of an Elagabalus. What chance, what one event brought this evil thing to pass? Bear with me while I relate. Death approaches, and the shadow which foreruns him has thrown a softening influence over my Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.